and welcome to part one of a very special edition of Bare Naked Politics. I'm Julia Bell, and about 10 days ago, I sat and dissected the entire year of British politics with one of my personal heroes, Jolyon Rubinstein. In fact, the day that we met up to do this episode was the very day that the video leak came out where Allegra Stratton was joking about this Downing Street Christmas party that allegedly took place in December 2020. So you'll probably be able to sense that we're kind of already riled up even before we sat down to record. Obviously, the podcast prior to this, I kind of honed in on that story. So yes, we touched on it plenty in this conversation, but you can listen about that if you're not caught up in more detail if you listen to the episode before at your leisure. Now, if you like people who, well, who just take the piss out of British politics for a living and who have really no inhibitions at all, whether it comes to being forcibly removed from government buildings or running up to Boris Johnson and asking him to sign a book about pathological lying, offering the former Chancellor George Osborne a GCSE maths textbook, to obviously getting himself blocked on Twitter by many key decision makers. This is Jolyon. This is what he's like. This is how he lives his life. And as usual, true to character, he did not hold back at all talking to me about lots of things that have happened this year.
I don't think the Labour Party at the minute has a soul. Did you trust a fucking word that Matt Hancock ever said? Because I didn't. Am I being really preachy and sarcastic?
Yes.
Well, I'm quite annoyed about some of these things. Keir Starmer is ineffective communicator. I don't think he makes anyone come, Julia.
I mean, I thought we agreed on more. And then having gone through everything, I'm like, I hate everything you ever say.
I'm so pleased I agreed to do this podcast.
Joel won a BAFTA for his show The Revolution Will Be Televised, which he made alongside Hayden Prowse, who he affectionately calls his comedy wife. And that was the show that switched me onto him. That was the show that I discovered him back in the day watching it on BBC Three. And it's what led me to actually slide into his DMs, if I'm being honest with you. And then since then, he's been up to all sorts. He's been super busy making more satirical content, like the BBC's Revolting, Channel 4's Ministry of Justice, which actually is much more recent. I played a couple of parts in that myself. In fact, my national TV debut was me saying the C word in my first ever sketch.
Hello there. Can I talk to you for a second about our online service? It basically gets you more followers on social media. It's free. So it'll take the toil out of trolling. What it does is it auto-generates 10 posts that are completely hate-filled, and then it will post them on your behalf, saving you loads of time, so then you can go about reassessing your life choices.
Say that again.
So a lot of our users enjoy casual misogyny, homophobia. It's up to you, really.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
It sounds fucking awful.
I'm a guy I love people.
Yeah, and that's why you've not got as many followers as you should.
That's true. How many followers do you have?
I've got about 25,000. Oh. Yeah, but I call everyone so it really helps.
This is the kind of influence he is. It's the first time I ever featured on national TV. I said the word and Joel is just as busy making as he is doing. He even formatted the hip-hop comedy quiz show Don't Hate the Players on ITV2. And Jolyon's become a mentor as well as a sort of dear friend, which means you're not gonna hear me being as respectful towards him as I have been perhaps to other guests, and vice versa, quite frankly. And just to sort of carry on with this theme of unprofessionalism, you might hear drinks being poured / spilled, but the truth is we both just kind of forgot the microphone was there, and I hope that's actually quite enjoyable to listen to, because you really get how we really feel about a lot of this stuff. It wouldn't be Christmas without, you know, semi-inebriated political arguments. So I hope you enjoy that. This is part one, where you will hear us meander through the months of January to around May 2021. I'll drop you off right at the start, where I was trying to work out how to introduce Joel, since he spins so many professional plates at once.
Is that all the titles? Saturated producer, comedian, political commentator.
I'm not sure I'd even go as far as political commentator, really. I think
just aggressive tweeter.
Well, I'd go producer, legitimate. Mm-hmm. Writer, performer, legitimate. Okay. Director, ish.
We're not doing ish.
No, I'd go with director is fair enough. Satirist.
Jolyon is going to sit with me and go through the whole year.
The whole thing.
I don't know how happy he is about it, because we're going to be here for like probably 2 hours.
Well, it's been a quiet year.
Yeah, especially today. The day that we're recording this is a particularly busy one. But what we're going to do is we're just going to chew the fat over the state of the political chaos in 2021. So, Joel, when you think back over this past 12 months in politics, are you happy with everything?
Over the moon. I mean, it's been just a wonderfully smooth year, and a really fantastic year for most people. Mm-hmm. Economically, spiritually, socially. No, this year has been and continues to be profoundly challenging on many levels, mainly because I think people are so exhausted. I think that is what's really different about this year, is that I would argue that, and it may sound a little dramatic what I'm about to say, but I would argue that in peacetime Britain, so really from 1945 onwards, mm-hmm. I'm not sure that the people of this country started a year more exhausted than they started 2021.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
And in any circumstances, that would have been extremely challenging. But what we dealt with in January was the legal ramifications of Brexit becoming a reality. Sovereignty, moving from a supernatural body in the EU that was able to have some effect on the laws of the land, to a state that is unto itself sovereign only to Parliament.
Yeah.
And that at a time when there was a huge parliamentary majority for one party, the Conservative Party. And there have been huge, huge ramifications of that, that because we have been so exhausted, because our energy to really deal with anything other than, am I able to see my granddad?
Yeah.
Can I go to work? Is my cousin, who, you know, works as a care worker, is she going to lose her job because she hasn't got a vaccine? These are very unique circumstances to start a year within. Mm-hmm. For any time in history.
So what are you saying? We basically started the year in a vulnerable place. And so we were ripe for a government to take advantage, especially because they had such a big majority. Is that, like, cutting through what you're saying, is that kind of the crux of it?
So instead of answering your question, like most politicians, I'm going to frame my own question.
Okay.
So like you said, what's the crux of it?
Yeah.
Right. Now, to answer that question, I want you and your listeners to consider something. So we'll talk, I guess, at some point through this dialogue about what I've been doing over the last sort of year. And one of the crazy ideas I had was to turn George Orwell's life into a limited series, because I think he's someone... It's amazing. Did you know there's no piece of video or audio of George Orwell at all?
Right.
Which is kind of mad, right?
But perfect, because he wrote 1984, which is a commentary on we're all going to end up being videoed all the time.
Yeah. And
the guy got out of the game just in time, right, before exactly. It all came
exactly.
through.
But also, you've worked in the BBC, right? You've done work at the BBC.
I still do work for the BBC.
Right, so new broadcasting house, you walk out, there's a statue of George Orwell.
Right.
Right. He is a huge part of our public consciousness. Mm-hmm. Everyone claims to have read 1984, but no one's fucking read it. So I started to look quite forensically into his life. Fascinating stories. Bizarrely, actually quite similar to what me and Hayden did in The Revolution Will Be Televised. He literally used to dress up and pretend to be like someone from Wigan or something and go down. No one believed him at all, but when he wrote like Down Now in London and Paris, he was just pretending to be, you know, like a coal miner or whatever, and everyone was like, who's this toff trying to pretend to be a pauper? A bit like us, really, but except in his day it was, you know, scribbling stuff down rather than, you know, doing stunts. But I came across an essay that he'd written called The Lion and the Unicorn, and the time that this essay was written, what he was really trying to do, this is the eve of the Second World War, was he was trying to galvanise the left into supporting the war effort, which a lot of people had concerns with after the First World War, but also on grounds of, you know, not wanting to be involved with militarism, you know, not wanting to be involved with the war effort. And when he wrote it, he hits on something about England and the British. And I want to read this to you because I think it has huge pertinence today.
Okay.
So this is me reading George Orwell.
A dramatic reading. By Julian.
The Lion, the Unicorn. Okay. England is not the jewelled isle of Shakespeare's much-quoted passages, nor is it the inferno depicted by Dr. Goebbels. More than either, it resembles a family, a rather stuffy Victorian family, with not many black sheep in it, but with all its cupboards bursting with skeletons. It has rich relations who have to be kowtowed to, and poor relations who are horribly sat upon. And there is a deep conspiracy of silence about the source of the family income. It is a family in which the young are generally thwarted and the most power is in the hands of irresponsible uncles and bedridden aunts. Still, it is a family. It has its private language and its common memories. And at the approach of an enemy, it closes ranks. A family with the wrong members in control, that perhaps is as near as one can come to describing England in a phrase. It's quite powerful, right? And he seems to kind of, for me anyway, it cements something which I hope throughout this conversation we will talk a lot about, which is the English psyche and how in this 12 months when we were exhausted, mm-hmm. frustrated and more than ever genuinely worried about the food on our plates and a roof over our heads, how that situation has been utilised, understood and then driven by an agenda that is the most radical agenda that certainly in either of our lifetimes, mm-hmm. and I'm talking about a legislative agenda here,
changing laws every day.
We're not talking here about media hype or headlines that we see. We're talking about actual laws mm-hmm. that are being changed, why they're being changed, and why now.
Okay.
And that's very important.
I think it's interesting, just before we start, that this comparison to a family, and this year and last year particularly, I remember when the Black Lives Matter movement was at its peak, and there was this onus on everyone to criticise and commentate on your own family dynamic.
Right.
Like, who in your family is saying things that are unacceptable? Who in your family needs educating? There was this movement, wasn't there, to look introspectively.
Yeah.
And because we were all in lockdown together, you were forced to do it. And sometimes it was extra uncomfortable because you were stuck with people every day and you thought, I don't have the time or patience to be political when I have to see you in the kitchen in an hour. I can't just leave this debate as one can on Twitter. So I think that's a really interesting comparison, especially now.
Well, let's dig into that, because one of the first things he says are there are relatives we need to kowtow to. Right. So let's think about that for a moment.
Okay.
So most obviously, in terms of Britain, the relative that we kowtow to is our was child, now sort of father.
Yeah, student becomes the master.
The United States.
Yeah, totally. Right?
So on the 6th of January, we had the Capitol insurrection, which was, I think, without any shadow of a doubt, in my political lifetime, the moment where liberal democracy was most nakedly vulnerable. USA!
It is hard to put into words what exactly we witnessed today, because we have not seen this before. Thousands storming the Capitol after a rally with President Trump, during which he urged them to march on the Capitol, where a joint session of Congress was debating and working to certify the election as our democracy dictates. Instead, they were halted by protesters who smashed through the doors, broke their way into the Capitol, making it to the Senate chamber, and throughout the Capitol, overwhelming police.
Stop the steal! It's our country, we want it back!
Now, let's look at Britain and that day, okay?
On the 6th of January.
Well, the 6th up to the 31st, right? We are in a state of utter and dark, dark social derision. We had Christmas locked off after we were told we would have Christmas with our relatives. I spent Christmas Day in North London seeing my brother and my niece. First time we haven't seen our parents, ever. Our whole lives on Christmas Day. Close family. And then my mum's diabetic, so she is, you know, high risk. So we were very careful. And then the legal ramifications of Brexit take hold. In this podcast, what I'm going to try and do is I'm going to throw forward to what these things mean as we move forward. Because the reality is that up until the 31st of January, if a law had been passed in this country, which contravened the European Convention on Human Rights, for instance, it could be challenged in the court.
Yeah.
That is no longer the case. Parliament is sovereign.
Yeah.
So anything that passes into law
is unchallengeable.
Is unchallengeable and potentially the law forever. Because it takes a lot of political capital to come into government to say, you know, I'm just going to reverse everything that's just been done.
You have to have a massive majority. And this does feel like a rare treat for Boris Johnson. I suppose not for you. But for Boris Johnson.
Oh, he's loving it.
Can you tell he doesn't like Boris Johnson? But you know, this is a rare treat for a Prime Minister to have such a sway. And I do think he rode off the back of Brexit. Get Brexit done. That was his way of getting in.
Completely.
Now he's in. While I'm here, I'll pass everything that I've ever wanted to pass and more. And I do think there's almost this attitude of, fucking hell, no one's really stopping us. Okay, now it's like this greediness, isn't it? Of,
yeah.
While we're stopping, you know, noise, we're allowing the police to have controls of how noisy protests should be. Why don't we throw in the wording of, let's just stop protests from being a nuisance? Like, these are the laws that are being passed.
Julia, if you turned up at a protest under the crime policing and sentencing bill that is being even more beefed up, which we'll come to, if you turned up with a scarf that they believed was incendiary,
yeah,
they could arrest you.
Yeah.
That is quite extraordinary.
Oh, this is a terrifying bill.
It's extraordinary. And it's really important because, as I was saying, there are many, many aspects of things that happen this year that we'll go through that you need to look ahead now at what this country is becoming.
Right, let's start from the beginning, can
let's
we?
Let's start from the beginning.
For fuck's sake, because we've been talking for half an hour. So, January.
January.
From the top, please. Brexit was made official on the 1st of January, 2021. Previous to that, of course, listeners to my podcast will know that we were in this transition period where the plan was to use that time to negotiate a sensible agreement with the EU, exit.
And with Northern Ireland.
Trade, well, how to...
Because there was going to be no barrier, right? There was no barrier in the North Sea. That was the whole point.
There were promises that both Northern Ireland's relationship with the UK would not change and that it would be a essential part of the UK with no difference, no differential treatment, and the border between the Republic of Ireland and the Northern Ireland would be protected. Of course, we now know that basically impossible, having seen years...
But it was fine, because they were our fish. Because there are fish then, so it was fine.
Well, as long as we've got control of that, and even then we don't.
We're going to come back to this, because there were our fish, but not our migrants.
We can talk about fish all you like.
As we keep going.
But the end of 2020 was defined by, you know, our government having been shell-shocked by the pandemic, not expecting it to come around the corner, having to completely focus their attention on that, and then last minute going, fuck, Brexit's happening in January.
Do you believe that?
Yes.
Do you really believe that?
I think there was an element of, let's play political chicken with the EU negotiators. Let's pledge to them, like, we're happy to leave with no deal. But I think deep down, the government knew we are going to leave with a deal. Not quite sure what that's going to look like. And then the months of October, November and December were just scraping something together.
I don't believe that. I think that Boris Johnson, his leadership style is to allow time to ebb and ebb and ebb away until there are only one or two choices. Now, you've got to remember that other administrations have not operated in that way. They have not just let the clock tick down. This whole narrative was, we will allow the EU to negotiate up until the last point, because we all know that the EU loves doing that. That was the narrative. The EU... just they'll change
sense.
Everything at the last point, and that's what the EU do.
Wait, what are you saying? That Boris Johnson intentionally...
Boris Johnson let the clock tick down so that the options available to him lessened, right?
Why would he want that?
Because he is a intelligent, very, very smart man.
I'm sick of hearing this commentary about knows, him being this secret genius.
Hang on a minute. He knows what he's doing. He's always known what he's doing. From the moment he started reporting on bending bananas in the EU, he understood the political capital that came from his absurdity.
Bunches of more than two or three bananas. You cannot sell bananas with abnormal curvature of the fingers. Why should they tell us? Yeah. Why should they tell us how powerful our vacuum cleaners should be? Yeah. Why should they tell us how powerful our hair dryers should be, ladies and gentlemen? This is not a matter for an international, supranational body to dictate to the British people.
This man is not ignorant. He's not incapable. He's a highly educated, extremely well-connected player of the public mind. The problem is that he's constantly on a campaigning footing. So when it comes to actually legislating, you know, he surrounds himself with sycophants for a purpose, because logic was abandoned at a point where a man who knew the costs to the British economy of Brexit decided to kowtow to a group of people that put him in power, you know, with no regard for really the public interest.
Okay, well, this has been your argument from the beginning, and we all know that you are openly disapproving of Brexit, to say the least.
But it's done now.
Exactly. So one question I have for you is, have all your concerns come true, or do you recognise that there was a smidgen of fear-mongering going on? In part from yourself.
Let's look at the fear-mongering, shall we? Let's go sector to sector.
Do you accept that term?
I think that it is a term a bit like woke. I think that there are certain phrases that are invented by the right-wing commentariat which are meant to disavow one of rational thought.
Yeah, so you right? say this is dangerous and they say you're fear-mongering.
Sure. Okay, that was a good example.
So what is it about Brexit particularly that you think has been detrimental? What are some...
Let's talk about it.
Dolian, you laugh at that as if everyone knows. I think there's been an expert approach here to say, see all these concerns that everyone had. Yes, it hasn't been quite as perfect as we imagined, but life isn't that different, which I dispute as well. But I'm asking you to share what you think are the most tangible examples.
Okay, well, let's start with fishing.
Okay, 0.something% of the economy, but okay.
Sure, but it was a huge, it was political dynamite, right? I mean, it was utilised as political dynamite. So the largest fish market in the country, right, now can't operate because they've got no one to sell fish to. It's that sad. It's we are genuinely talking about generations and generations of people, because in most instances, this was a sort of intergenerational business. Mm-hmm. They've had their entire business destroyed overnight.
We thought we was going to carry on after Brexit. The markets supposedly were sorted, and they've slammed the door in my buyer's face.
Since Brexit, the EU has stopped British fishermen from selling oysters, mussels, clams and scallops to member states.
If I never had a bit of money in the bank and my wife wasn't working, I think we'd be out of an house, shouldn't it?
If you look at any export business in the UK, be that farming, but it goes further than that, because it starts affecting people like musicians.
Yeah.
The service industry as well. It's not simply that. They've been absolutely and thoroughly sort of grotted. There is very little they can do about it. And, you know, I'm sure you, like me, have seen a small business in the last 12 months who's put up a tweet or something on Instagram saying, we can no longer export to X, Y or Z countries because the tariffs mean that we simply can't do it.
Yeah.
I think this hit the service industry far less than it hit manufacturing and agriculture and the production of foodstuffs. But in most cases, these were businesses that had sort of been co-opted with our national identity somehow. Like, you know, we're going to sell British beef all around the world. Yay. Without anyone really understanding that being a part of the common market was why we were successfully exporting. I don't think anything that I complained about with Brexit has not come true. I think they've all been borne out. I don't think any of it was even fear-mongering.
I actually, like, you know, I'm teasing you, but I agree with you insofar as it's not saved us money. This was number one. It'll stop immigration and migration, illegal and legal, and it'll save us money.
But what was
neither
that,
of those things
but also,
happened.
What was that about, Julia, when we talk about we stop migration? What it really was saying was, we're going to stop brown people coming into this country.
I think that's unfair. Hang on.
Okay.
Anyone who's listening to this who voted for Brexit, you're basically...
I'm not saying that about everyone who
voted
for Brexit.
Okay, well then. Because I think there's some people that I spoke to that sort of said... especially in places where jobs aren't, you know, falling like confetti, I don't want to feel like I'm up against... Johnny's just pouring a glass of wine. I think you need it for this. I don't want to go up against somebody who's not British for a job that's already few and far between. I don't know if it was racial always, and I agree that some of the campaigning was racial and it's fucked, but for some people it was just a matter of they were being told to blame a group of people, i.e. immigrants, for a problem that they genuinely felt. It wasn't a fake problem. A lack of opportunities is a real problem, and if you're told time and time again by certain parts of the media and by the people in power, here's who to blame, by the way, you can stop this problem.
As someone with a Jewish surname, right, I want to be super clear about this. Dehumanisation is at the cause of all of the biggest, absolutely horrific disasters that have befallen humanity. And this goes for the way, for instance, the Americans spoke about the Japanese. So it was fine to drop a nuclear bomb on them, right? This goes to a core of othering. And it comes back to why I wanted to read the George Orwell quote, because something I said to you, which I know worried you greatly, that why I wanted to do this podcast today is I've been working on a show that was inspired by, around this time last year, a story that I read. And for me, on some level, this one story, it gets to the heart of so much of this, which was, it was a story about a guy who was a former wedding DJ in Wolverhampton, who had got so annoyed with Labour about immigration that he moved down to Kent to form a vigilante group to take boats out into the Channel to turn round migrant dinghies.
Oh my God.
Right? Okay. This is really, really happening in our country now, right?
Yeah.
Now, there is so much in that that is terrifying, almost vaguely comic, also some sort of, I believe, echo of what people are seeing online that's happening in America.
But Joel, you're like, the point I'm making is, you know, I think that you were saying a part of the reasoning behind Brexit was a fear of otherness.
No, it's just because they utilise nationalism. I don't think they necessarily understood. I think Cummings probably got it, but I think Cummings was only really interested in winning. But
yeah, so and he knew what would work, and he knew what would make people take.
Nationalism.
But I, like, listen, I come from Leeds, and this is a place where I could not stay if I wanted a job in media. So when you've got, and this is, I mean, I'm a fucking privileged person, but when you've got that amplified in towns where there just are not jobs, and then you have a privileged, educated person in power saying, I have found the cause of this problem.
Mm.
It's immigration.
What do they know? What do they know of the impact of immigration on school places and hospital waiting lists and GP surgeries? They know nothing about it.
Nothing.
They know absolutely nothing about it.
But the thing is that you've got to also remember that I believe that a fascist lurks within all of us. And that's much more scary. I'm not talking about something outside of you. I'm talking about how your fears and your concerns can be manipulated to make you scared that someone else is coming to take your biscuits. Because it isn't more or less than that. Right? Like you were saying, look, you know, job opportunities are drying up. That is not because of migration.
Nor have I ever said it is, but I understand
sure,
what you're saying.
That
it's
is
easy
because,
to tell that narrative to people who are already vulnerable.
Right, so say there was, say, 55, 65 minicab companies next to Leeds Uni's Halls of Residence, where I used to stay when I was in National Youth Music Theatre when I was a kid, right? How many of those exist now because of Uber? Very little, I would imagine. That's got nothing to do with migrants and everything to do with the government's allowance or not of large corporations to operate unchallenged in their legal constituency.
Okay, so we kind of talked about Brexit. Actually, let me just clarify something. One thing that I hate.
Yeah.
One thing that really got under my skin was when the government tried to treat us like we were stupid when the issue arose about our shortage of lorry drivers and HGV drivers.
Yeah.
And
is this February?
No, this is recent, but this is something about Brexit. This is a rollout consequence from Brexit, which was we didn't have any HGV drivers. And if you spoke to any kind of CEOs of HGV lorry companies, they'd say like Romanian drivers, Polish drivers and whatnot. These guys are keeping us going. Now we don't have any because they've all fucked off home. And the point was, Boris Johnson stood on a platform and said, we don't have any HGV drivers, and it's a great thing.
And then he also said, maybe firemen should retrain as
HGV drivers. No, that wasn't even the most insulting part. He said, this is a great thing because now driving a lorry or an HGV is a high-skilled job. It's a job in demand. Therefore, sure, we can drive up wages. You can pay people more for this job. We can force big corporations to pay these people more.
The logic of what you're saying is that the shortages and the short-term problems are an inevitable result of the policy, that to get higher productivity, to get higher wages, we as a country have to go through some bumps, some shortages, some queues on the way. And that, folks, is what you voted for. When you voted for Boris's Brexit, that's what it meant.
When people voted for change in 2016 and when people voted for change again in 2019, as they did, they voted for the end of a broken model of the UK economy that relied on low wages and low skill and chronic low productivity. And we're moving away from that.
So he's telling the public that this is intentional while simultaneously writing letters to German residents who had driving licenses issued before 1999. And the reason he was writing letters to these people was because they technically qualified to drive HGVs just because of the way licensing worked in Germany at that time. And this means that there was one man who wrote into the BBC, he's a professor at a university in Germany. He got a letter from our government saying, do you fancy coming to the UK and driving a lorry because we're desperate?
It's extraordinary.
So we knew this was happening. We were seeing reports of it, but our Prime Minister was standing up on a stage and saying, this shortage is an intentional consequence of Brexit.
Did you know that, do you remember when the crisis started, there was a big news story, which was that we have kindly said that we will grant a 3-month licence. Do you remember that?
Like an emergency
Did
license.
You know that the day that that licence was supposed to come to an end was Christmas Eve?
This year. Right.
It's kind of extraordinary, the lack of humanity that runs through this government at the moment. Because any sane human being would one understand that probably someone driving all across Europe probably wouldn't just be like, oh, 3 months... Oh, yippee.
Especially if you're a professor.
That's a bloody good deal for me, isn't it? Because do you know what? I don't need to drive anywhere else. I can just drive to Loughborough Junction. You know what I mean? Or Sheffield Hallam. And I'll just drive back. Oh, I have to leave on Christmas Eve, do I? What does that say? Get the migrants out before fucking Jesus gets here.
No, but also there's the cultural element as well of like, oh, let me help a country that have just explicitly said they don't want me there.
All these people say they're Christians. All these people will literally go to Westminster Abbey, to Canterbury Cathedral, and they will listen to the story of Jesus Christ, the story of Jesus of Nazareth, who was an immigrant who came to somewhere and asked for a room.
In an inn.
In an inn.
And they said no.
That inn was
the UK.
It's quite extraordinary, though. It really is. And the cognitive dissonance of these people is even, it's beyond. Because, I mean, just at the time of recording, you know, there was a debate this morning about whether Britain should forgo the Geneva Convention on Human Rights because, in the words of Matthew Paris, former MP, now Times columnist, we haven't got room for everyone in the world to come here. Which is the presupposition that, one, they want to fucking come here, right? And two, it's the huge lack of understanding that whereas we took over 20,000 refugees last year, Germany took 1 million.
Although Germans weren't all happy about that, you know.
Which is an absolute understatement. A lot of Germany is profoundly angry about it, and that's why the far right in Germany, the AfD...
They're on the way up.
And yet they did it, Julia. And this is the point.
Angela Merkel did it. Different kettle of fish to Boris Johnson.
Really? It's so weird you say that, because I think
I promise he's not going to be this preachy and sarcastic the whole time.
Let's keep going. Am I being really preachy and sarcastic?
Yes.
Well, I'm quite annoyed about some of these things.
Okay. March. Spring.
Spring this year. What a wonderful time that was.
A time of hope.
But lockdown still hadn't come off then, had it?
No. We had a long shift
so
in
insane.
Yet. But in terms of what was happening in Parliament and within the law, the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill was introduced on a larger scale. And to give everyone context, I did a big podcast episode about this for anyone who wants more info. But this is a massive document. And if passed, and it still isn't yet, technically, if passed, it would affect so many different elements of the law, crime, policing, and all these other kind of sectors. Just to give you a quick idea, it's a very conservative bill. It has big emphasis on policing. It gives the police more power, and that's an understatement. It's got tough policies on the criminal justice system, lengthening prison sentences, especially when it comes to the likes of grooming or child abuse, these sorts of areas. Nowadays, there's also more discussions about, you know, even things like should heckling women with sexual content on the street be outlawed. These are all parts of this overall conversation that the Conservative Party have introduced. Now, the Conservatives are saying, look, toughening up on crime, it was part of our manifesto in 2019. It's actually a big part of what we campaigned on, and a massive swathe of the population voted for it, so you shouldn't be surprised that we're bringing this in. But I have quite openly voiced that I'm quite troubled by this bill. You know, Priti Patel in the House of Commons on the 15th of March, she said this, I'll quote it. I note that you being the opposition, I note that you will be voting against these crucial measures.
Against measures to support victims of violent crimes, including young women and girls.
That was her way of saying, if you don't vote for this bill, you clearly don't support victims of violent crimes. And that conflates all these different issues. It just melds all these different issues into one. And that's what worries me, because I don't like it when politicians say, if you don't vote for this bill, you clearly don't care about this. And what opposition parties were struggling with was, yes, there was some elements of the bill that they might agree with, but there's so much to it that they're struggling. Another thing that this bill actually focuses on is protests. And Jolyon fucking loves protesting, so he particularly is really incensed by this bill. But actually, as someone who supports democracy and free speech, so am I. And the terminology in the bill is what I have trouble with, because even things like noise limits are being brought into it. And then the kind of term that I have particular trouble with is this idea of intentionally or recklessly causing public nuisance. That's a quote from the bill.
It's brilliant, isn't it?
So if someone intends...
Public nuisance! How dare you!
Which is what a protest is, right? Jolyon, as a career, has built a lifestyle of being a public nuisance.
I don't know about that.
So this point...
Protest gives great production values. Scale,
right, so the point
drama,
here is,
jeopardy.
Clicks. So the point is, if something intentionally or recklessly causes public nuisance, those people would be liable for arrest. We know that this bill hasn't been passed yet. Currently, as we're recording, it's waiting on its third reading in the House of Lords. But the Queen hasn't signed it. Joel, you've talked a lot about this bill.
I have. And I'd like to quote one of my heroes. Yeah, former Prime Minister Theresa May. Who, if anyone has followed my career, knows, huge fan of Theresa. Love her dance moves. Loves what she does. Like, her vibe is...
Yeah, but do you miss her now?
Inordinately. It's terrifying. But Theresa May voiced concerns about the proposed bill, and this is word for word. She insisted that the government has to walk a line between being popular and populist and telling lawmakers that our freedoms depend on it. Now, this is stalwart of freedom, Theresa May. And I want to tell you a bit, dear listener, about some concerns that, you know, myself and many other people have about it. And I think it's really important because there are individual clauses of the bill that are of supreme concern. And since I did this research, the bill has been bulked up.
Yeah.
Because if you remember, the timing of this couldn't have been more excruciating, because there was a period of time, not in March when it was introduced later in the year, where we had just seen the horrific murder of Sarah Everard by a serving police officer, which no doubt we will come on to later in the podcast. But for instance, Clause 59 of the Policing, Crime and Sentencing Bill, which is going through Parliament, as we've said, says that being a public nuisance will be criminalised and could get you 10 years in jail.
10 years? I'm not across 10 years that. In jail. I did not know it was 10 years.
Just for a prank, for instance. So
you'd be fucked.
When we bought, you know, a ton of bullshit to Parliament, said, hey, do you want to spray some more bullshit over people?
We've just got a big delivery of bullshit that we need to put to Parliament.
The MPs ran out of bullshit, so they need a fresh batch to feed to the public. I mean, the MPs can either, like, filtrate it through Parliament, or they can just spray it over people on the street. They used to make it inside Parliament, but they need to outsource because they ran out.
Look, this is grade A bullshit, you know?
It's also Prime Minister's question time, so they're going to be pretty annoyed if we don't deliver the bullshit before PMQs.
Was it you did with Thames Water? Didn't you bring them a picture full of human shit?
We brought, yeah, it was a picture of, well, as it's been, our rivers are full of shit. So, I mean, it's quite a relevant thing to do. And we were way ahead of that game, you know, four, five years. But just to keep going, you know, and I do believe this, is that, look, every single protest that's ever been organised in history has been organised in order to disrupt. And, you know, if history teaches us anything, it's that, you know, things don't change unless the status quo is disrupted.
Yep.
And the intention appears to be to create an environment where you can make a lot of noise as long as you stay in your lane. You know, so that any movements that's deemed to be effective at changing hearts and minds can therefore be criminalised. That's quite scary as an idea, isn't it?
The idea of staying in your lane as a change maker, It's contradictory. You can't stay in your lane if you're going to make change.
But I'd argue that, you know, if this Policing, Crime and Sentencing Bill does pass in Parliament...
Which it will.
Well, let's see. But it signals an active attack on a cornerstone of British democracy. And, you know, perhaps the significance is that freedom to speak truth to power without the fear of recrimination or criminal sanction is a British value. You know, a fundamental tenet of free speech.
But also, your right to bring up Sarah Everard, your right to bring up the public mood at the time, which was, you know, it was deeply heavy, but there was also so much introspection. Why don't I feel safe? And why have I accepted that for so long? And what this brought up was, I worry, an opportunity for the government to say, well, vote for this bill, and then you'll be protecting people who are vulnerable in that situation. And I found that deeply troubling. So, you know, I'll say it again.
I'm not surprised. I can't imagine what it must be like at the moment. You know, and I mean this, walking around, you know, most women I know will have a drink with their friend, they'll get on a tube.
Yeah. Sarah Everard was walking around Clapham. Right. You know, this is something that we've all done in London.
An area where when you walk past the bus stops, it says, here is a fast track to get to your children into Cambridge and Oxford. I mean, this is a very high net worth, you know, gentrified area.
But for me, I felt uncomfortable specifically because I somewhat imagine that I'm a bit more right wing than you when it comes to criminal punishment and the justice system.
Well, I'm not sure about that.
Okay, well, that's interesting. That's something we can explore. But I, at that time, felt like I want the fear of death in anyone who tries to fuck with me on the street.
You're right.
That's what I want.
I think that's why Cressida Dick said that if you as a woman have a concern about a police officer not being a police officer, you should hail down a fucking bus.
Yeah, that was the official advice, amongst others, but that was some of
the... No, but let's just seriously think about this. Mm-hmm. This is the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, the highest law officer in the Metropolitan Police, saying that the best thing you could do...
in this scenario,
is to... ask a fucking bus driver. Okay, this is the reality that we're living through in 2021. And this is why, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, the laws that are being passed have hugely, I would argue, the most significance in my lifetime.
Yeah.
And yes, I can be dramatic. I'm not going to try and joke about that. My name's Jolly and Rubenstein, for fuck's sake. Okay, but this is a serious thing. There is so much absurdity in the public sphere right now. And all my female friends are terrified.
Yeah, but this is the point I'm trying to make. Terrified. I want... I think it helps to have the fear of God and the fear of hell in people who are thinking of fucking with women on the streets.
Sure.
For someone who has felt unsafe their whole life, as everyone who I think identifies as female, and to be honest, beyond that, on the streets of the UK does, I want that message to be sent. However, the problem I have with this bill... is while it does have these conservative policies that a big majority of the UK voted on, which is we'll toughen up on crime, it also includes this element of we're going to completely squash your ability to protest. I'm not saying that lightly. Noise nuisance in general, not submitting your route before you go on a march, these are things that, for me, squash a democracy. But it's being conflated with... we're going to toughen up crime on streets. And for me, I don't feel comfortable with the Home Secretary saying, you either support this bill and then you support victims of these crimes, or you don't support this bill and therefore you're happy for people to run rife on the streets. That kind of lack of nuance terrifies me.
I am very proud that the suffragette movement was part of our political legacy, our heritage. At the time, they were seen... to be disruptors, to be...
a nuisance.
A total nuisance.
Yeah.
You couldn't have said, that Pankhurst was in any way anything other than a nuisance. There is a statue of her in Westminster, in Parliament Square now. Who else has a statue there? Nelson Mandela. What was he called by Thatcher? A terrorist. Gandhi, right? Wow. These are people who were seen as the total... absolute opposite of helpful to democracy. No protest movement.
This should be renamed to Nuisance
But
Square.
No protest movement has ever started out being anything other than a pain in the backside.
And these protest movements have literally, positive change is an understatement.
I find it redeeming somehow that Britain, 20 years, 30 years after the event, says, you know what, we were wrong. And... Nelson Mandela, Pankhurst, Gandhi, they should have statues erected to them because it was a moment that changed the world. Mm-hmm. I find that hugely redeeming.
Let's move on. We're still in spring. At the end of March, Meghan and Harry spoke to Oprah.
Did you make Kate cry?
No.
So where did that come from? Was there a situation where she might have cried or she could have cried?
No, the reverse happened. And I don't say that to be disparaging to anyone because it was a really hard week of the wedding and she was upset about something, but she owned it and she apologized and she brought me flowers and a note apologizing. And she did what I would do if I knew that I hurt someone, right? To just take accountability for it. What was shocking was, 6-7 months after our wedding?
Mm-hmm.
That the reverse of that would be out in the world. I would have never wanted that to come out about her ever, even though it had happened. I protected that from ever being out in the world.
My father and my brother, they are trapped. They don't get to leave. And I have huge compassion for that.
Yes or no?
So much time for this.
Right. Yes or no? When you see a article or an interview by Meghan and or Harry, do you click yes or no?
Does Meghan Markle... an American Hollywood actress who married into a family well known for their let's just call it fuckery at this point, right? Does she have huge amounts of my personal sympathy?
She did say, I'm guessing the answer is no.
I would, no, she doesn't have huge amounts.
Not huge amounts.
Right.
However, you're up at night, but not for long.
There is something very interesting about this couple, and it is race. So let's not escape that.
Yeah, I agree.
There is a part of British society that is an absolutely white supremacist part of British society. There is a war on empathy. Every day, the Sun outsells the Guardian 10 to 1. Right, let's just put it simply as that. And that in itself is concerning.
But Joel, why are you not more persuasive?
Well, in what sense am I persuasive?
So, no, I'm not saying you're persuasive.
No, but in what sense am I persuasive?
I'm saying you're not.
I would argue that I'm very persuasive.
Yeah, amongst your cohort.
No, not at all.
Joel, come on. You are a spokesperson for someone who already knows how they feel in many ways.
I don't agree with that, Julia. All right? Okay. I think that talking about empathy is very important. I don't.
But you're empathetic to people who already agree with you. To people who have been, quote unquote, I'll use your words, confused. You're immediately disparaging, and you're quick to call them.
I don't think that's true. I've said again and again.
You say that the Sun outsells the Guardian. I say that persuasion techniques are lost by the left.
I don't disagree with that. I think that's fair. I also don't consider myself to be hugely just left wing, right? Because I also disagree. I disagree with that statement.
What are you then?
I say I'm a humanist. I believe in empathy.
Me too. Where on the political spectrum do you sit?
I'd say even the idea of left and right has become completely and utterly pointless.
Okay.
Because the thing is that for me, and I think for most people listening to this, the three things that I want are free healthcare, public services that are looked after, cradle to grave, really, because I want to feel
everything
like
from education to social care.
Like, yeah, and I really mean, like, you know, even the first 100 days of a child's life, you know, what are the outcomes for that child, right? These are very, very profoundly important periods of time.
What's the third thing?
Healthcare. Basic empathy.
Okay.
Right, because the biggest divider that we currently have in this country is racial, right? The idea that we are operating under a system that doesn't have race at the core of it needs to be understood. Now, a lot of people are so exercised by this that even the National Trust putting up very, very small plaques in stately homes saying, hey, guess what? By the way, this place was built because, guess what? This guy's granddad's granddad.
Mm-hmm.
He made a lot of money out of slavery. That is so confronting to people in our country that they refuse to even give their, you know, monthly subscription to these people.
Yeah.
This underlies a huge problem that we have. And that's why I use that George Orwell quote. Right? It's a family with secrets and skeletons in a closet. And we are still 60, 70 years after that was written, pre-World War II. We can't admit any of that
to
ourselves.
We're still cowtying. Okay,
but,
well, then
I want to ask you a question. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that we can't come to terms with it? Because I'm clear about why in my head.
I think that this country, rightly for many reasons, but wrongly for others, has a huge amount of pride. And it's ironic because we're not big on pride. We're awkward about pride, right? Like if we hear Americans talk about their love for their country, we cringe. And then when we hear, you know, the, what's the little thing they say about the flag? I pledge allegiance to the flag.
Pledge of allegiance to the flag.
What's that called? Anyway, when they do that, I mean, I worked at Camp America. I cringed every single morning. And yet, something in me internally empathised with it because I feel that exceptionalism, I feel that love for my country in a different way. And part of that is characterised by how our identity is about being an underdog and being sarcastic and being self-deprecating, but that's part of who we are.
Right.
And so when you talk about nationalism, it is shrouded mostly rightly, but shrouded in this negativity, in this racism, in this exceptionalism, in this idea that we're better than others and therefore we should oppress or British resent them. But for me, some of that nationalism is rooted in a genuine love for the fact that we have, for example, an NHS, that during the pandemic we all put our rainbows in our windows and we wanted to, you know, back the fuck
let's
out of each
talk
other.
About that.
But, well, can we? Because we're up to April.
Well, let's because
your question was,
yeah, why?
Know, why do we why do we still submit to this?
You not know, submit.
Crooked old family word. That we kowtow to the elders and we, you know, we hide the badness from the youngers and that idea. And I'm saying that I think so much of it needs challenged and so much of it is problematic. But I also don't want people to feel like once they say I'm proud to be British, they're going to be told that they're a prick.
What Britain are they talking about? Because this is the key point, right?
So but when it's a movable object, just me, like America
but,
is.
Exactly. But for me, like, okay, so I'm very lucky. So I'm dyslexic. I had a university education. I did 4 years in university doing politics and international relations. Then I went to film school and did another 2 years, which is a lot of psychology. And I lived in America, in New York, in 2002. And I arrived in New York on the 11th of September, 2002. Everyone that I met in New York when I went to their houses had pictures on their walls of firefighters, policemen, army relatives in their generation.
Are you upset by that?
No, I think it's very interesting that the British don't really do that anymore.
No.
Why? Because of the Second World War. Recently, I read Sebastian Faulkes' Birdsong. I'd never read it before. And it talks in terrifying, grotesque detail about the realities of war. And I think the people of Europe suffered the indignity of materialised, metallic war. Guns, bombs, the frailty of human existence. Those episodes like the Somme, episodes like the Normandy landings, were full of the abject horrors of the ultimate sacrifice so many paid for who knows what, was his point. Who knows what? Because even though these great nation states were bellowing these profound truisms about Nazism, about the protection of liberty and all these things, the human cost of, say, I don't know, a guy from Hamburg who had two kids, who had a family, giving his life to something he didn't really understand, or a British soldier from Plymouth who decided to sign up at 16 and, you know, be on the beaches and have his body torn to pieces by a machine gun. They were living reality for Britain, for France, for Germany. They were our grandparents. In America, they didn't experience that, not in the same way. I'm not saying in any way that the human cost that American soldiers gave to the Second World War was anything to snipe at in any way. It just didn't take place.
Yeah, then. I get that.
So Europe and the European Union was built on preserving peace, right? Preserving peace is something
not
that...
not idealising police.
But it's not something we even really understand anymore. Because it was only... Seriously, it was only when I did my A-levels that I even, for a second, started even contemplating the human experience of war. Now, why, if you're 16 and you leave school...
Did you not, when you were studying... Because World War II is GCSE curriculum.
Sure, but I mean, I didn't really
I thought every day... I lost sleep over the idea of conscription.
Right, No, conscription, totally.
I used to think about my first ever boyfriend, he was called Charles.
Hey, Charles.
Hey, Charles.
Hey, man, big shout out today. Yeah. In the midst of the humanised chaos.
His sister was in my tap dancing class. And he,
amazing.
And he was just this great, strong, strapping, lovely British boy. I had that very vivid imagery of going to school every day, learning about what it was like to be his age, 17 years old, in Britain. In 1942, and then being torn away from your family, either by force or by kind of this macho voluntary mindset that a lot of young men had at the time.
Also just the sense of public duty, right?
I lost sleep over thinking about what would I do if Charles got that letter to say you're next. And I used to think about it. We're on Meghan and Harry, and then I've got to wait. If you could get rid of the monarchy tomorrow, would you? Yes or no?
No.
Why wouldn't you?
I think that if you had an elected head of state in this country at this time, it would be a huge, huge problem. Because I think that we're, again, living in a time of populism and nationalism. And I think that...
Bearing in mind, the Queen has never, ever in her entire tenure rejected a law. She's always ratified anything she's been presented with. So she's purely figurehead.
I've got huge problems with the monarchy and with the absolution.
So what is it about her that you think adds to our democracy?
I think that we're living in a time of huge uncertainty. And I think to take away another pillar at this point would be deeply detrimental.
Okay.
That said, I think that Republicans have a lot of rational salient points.
Republicans being people who want rid of the monarchy.
Well, Republic generally, which is an organisation that campaigns on the abolition of the monarchy.
Mm-hmm.
However, we don't know what's going to happen in the next 12 months. We're in a huge state of identity crisis in this country. And something I've said again and again in this podcast is, who are we? What are we? Who are we becoming?
What are we proud of?
But not just what are we... This is the point I'm making about the realities of the laws that are being passed and what that means for your children and your grandchildren.
Okay, May.
May.
We're in May. In May, we saw on the 6th, so early May, a series of elections in the UK, Scottish Parliament, Welsh Assembly, London Assembly, London Mayor, and this is the bit I want to talk about, the Hartlepool by election. Okay, so for anyone who's listening who's not across this, the Hartlepool by election acted, in my opinion, as a kind of part of a long list of blows to the Labour Party in that this is a constituency that has never voted Conservative. And in the 2021 May by-election, they did. And actually, by an overwhelming majority, the Conservative candidate, Jill Mortimer, who is now an MP, the MP for Hartlepool, she got almost double the amount of votes that the Labour candidate got.
I'm also immensely proud to be the first Conservative MP in Hartlepool for 57 years. Not only that, I am the first woman ever to be elected as MP for this town.
Now this, in the narrative of this Conservative momentum, let's forget how we feel right now. At the time of recording, the Conservatives aren't actually doing great in the polls. But at the time of spring 2021,
doing pretty good.
We can talk about that in a second. But I think, you know, the point is, at the time, I remember thinking, the Conservatives are unbeatable, they're inevitable. And then this Hartlepool by-election just shows a constituency in the northeast of England that's always been loyally Labour is willing to cross the... political path.
I'm going to say this in a really succinct way for a change. The north of England was a Labour stronghold in the 60s, in the 70s. New Labour came in the 90s, but during the Thatcher era, the core of the north, the industrial heartland of our country, steel, mining, they were gutted. They were replaced with nothing. And the new Labour government promised inward investment into those areas.
Also education, so social mobility.
It didn't happen.
It did.
Not on the level to compensate for the gutting.
But I think new Labour apologists would say we weren't in power long enough to have a long lasting effect.
They can say whatever they want.
Okay.
I'm not one of their apologists.
Okay. What do you think the Labour Party's number one problem is with capturing the imagination of the public?
I don't think the Labour Party, at the minute, has a soul. I don't think that they have an identity, and I don't think they have a mobilising narrative that captures the imagination of the future. We are living in a time where we have climate collapse, our system of government is hugely being called into question, our civil liberties are being curtailed, and everyone can see that we have a huge problem with oligarchy, which basically means utilising your position to enfranchise your mates into positions of power or giving them contracts without due
process. Or memberships to the House of Lords.
Sure.
Or COVID contracts.
Yeah, yeah. And that seems quite clear.
Yeah.
So why is the opposition doing so badly?
It's easy. This should be ripe. This should be
exactly.
ripe, fertile ground.
So let's go back to understand what's happening now, right? Jeremy Corbyn, by any meter, was far left compared to the centre of British politics. But forget just Piers Hammond, Tony Blair, even Clement Attlee. He was to the left of all of these people.
Okay.
The Labour Party has never, in the history of this country, won by going to the left. It has won by being centre-right. Now, you can
centre-left,
wish...
Centre-left, not centre-right.
Well, let me qualify this.
Okay.
You can wish away politicians, but you cannot wish away the British electorate. You cannot do it. Now, I am sympathetic to those who believe that the British electorate have been conditioned, manipulated, utilised by the press, all the weaknesses and concerns that they have othered into issues that, frankly, are not the real issues that matter, right? Whilst the top 1% of the world's sort of most unbelievably wealthy people were enriched beyond imaginings during the pandemic, those at the bottom suffered immeasurably. These things are all true. But the fact is, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter unless you win power. And the decision post-Corbyn was to tack to the right.
Yeah, which makes sense electorally.
It makes sense electorally, right? It makes sense on paper. The thing is that we're living in a time where what may make sense to some people on paper, statistically, doesn't work emotionally. And we're working in a time of emotions and identity politics. Now, Keir Starmer does not have the force of character, the rambunctiousness.
I'm so over this character thing. I'm so
Boris Johnson is entirely popular.
Who cares?
Everybody cares.
No, I'm so sick of this fucking personality
thing.
Yeah,
but it's not your choice or my choice about that.
But this is rooted in a lack of faith in the British public. Oh, they find him funny.
It's not
they find
at
Boris
all.
Listen to me. They find Boris Johnson funny, therefore they'll vote for him. How patronising. I don't think people fucking vote because of who they'd go for a pint with. I think people vote because of what will look after their rights and the rights of the people they love.
No, I don't agree. I think it's much more about football team now. It's about... I'll give you a good example. The first time I ever went to Germany, I was in my mid-20s. I'd never really read the Mail and the Sun or anything like that. But I still, when I got to Germany, I realised very quickly, on arriving in Germany, why do I not think Germans are funny? Why? Why have I got this weird image in my head? I was shocked. But the point is that we have national stereotypes for a reason, right? And we live within a bubble. And even if you don't read the Daily Mail, the Express, or the Times, or the Sun, you're still seeing it every single day. I think the point is that we are living in a time where, as I've said, we're exhausted,
mm-hmm.
we are kowtowed, and we're ready just for some form of leadership, man.
And
just
you
some
think
form
that
leadership.
Keir Starmer doesn't make the cut?
I don't think he makes anyone come, Julia. I don't think he
Does
makes
Boris
anyone...
Johnson?
As yes, absolutely. Sure. Boris Johnson, whether you like it or not, is a clown playing a clown.
I think there was also an element of, I can quick fix your problems. And I think these days we're living in an era where we are used to quick fixes.
I know.
We're used to short attention
terrifying.
Spans. And from our politics, if that can be provided, great. Am I judging people for that? No.
I think that what you're missing is that we're talking slightly at odds here.
Okay.
Because what you're talking about is realpolitik, the reality of a four-year election cycle, or five-year election
Tomorrow
cycle.
Tomorrow results.
Tomorrow results.
Yeah.
Fair enough. And that is a completely...
And the Labour Party haven't offered that yet.
And I agree. And I think it's a completely legitimate point of view. But to qualify what I was saying, what I'm talking about is a movement that has vision that people can imbue themselves with.
And understand.
And understand.
The Labour doesn't do that.
I couldn't agree more. Okay. I don't think that the Labour Party at the moment knows who it is or what it is. And when you talk about infighting in the left, it's something... I wouldn't even say at this point that... One, I necessarily identify as part of the cultural left. Because I think as a satirist, you're always... You need to be able to take the piss out of all sides and also be able to skewer all sides. That's the entire point of satire. It is completely redundant to be a satirist who just simply identifies with one group. What I think is very interesting is that the policy forums that look at where we will be in 2050 are not seen as valid or necessary because of our system. And let's not forget that we're living in a time where communist China works on a 10-year standard model. Our model is not sacrosanct. Our model is the reality that we currently have in Britain. And is it necessarily serving us? Because all it is doing is a sort of further perpetuation of quarterly return in the capitalist market, right? Which is literally like...
What are you saying? We should change the elections?
I think we are at a genuine point in our history where we have to review everything that's taking place because we are literally walking into dictatorship.
But this is the kind of thing, again, Joel, that like worries me about your ability to persuade. When you're talking big picture like that, we need to change the entire system. I don't want to get on board with that because I don't understand how it affects me.
Yeah, I get that.
In my life.
It is scary.
So the question remains.
Keir Starmer is an ineffective communicator. No. He's an ineffective emotional arbiter of the people. He doesn't capture the emotions of people and articulate it. What I find disparaging and dangerous about what you're saying mm-hmm. is that you are basically saying, look, we live within the system we live in. You're saying it's short-termism. We've got to have someone that rises. Why isn't this person being taken seriously? And I countered with, this person has no vision.
I agree with what you're saying.
I honestly think I could have had better cut through than Keir Starmer.
And I think you should go into politics for that reason. I think that Keir Starmer lacks vision too.
Mm.
But I refute this personality comment as the only reason
I
don't think it's relevant the same way that the media does.
It's terrifying to me that you don't think this.
I think you're right that
you've got a responsibility to your audience. You do.
So have you.
My audience is very clear on two clear points, right? We right now have a person that dominates headlines, right? So he looked at what Trump did. He took it even further, in my view now,
right?
I'm not talking about the realities of rise up against this government. I genuinely don't think Boris Johnson would do that. But I do think that it's important to ask ourselves, why is it that a naughty schoolboy who's a bit of a clown, who everyone thinks is an idiot...
So over this narrative...
Because it bores you personally.
It bores me.
Yeah. Because it's so depressing. That's why you're bored. Why are you bored by it?
I think you're conflating two problems. Okay. One, Keir Starmer doesn't have vision. And I agree with that.
Right.
I think it's dangerous that he went up to Blackpool, had a conference with ex-Labour voters awful. And said, can you tell me what I should do?
And that's what I want to try out on you. So I've got some strong ideas. I want to share them with you. I want you to tell me what you think.
If you're asking voters, what should I do? They're not going to vote for you. They want someone who goes, I'm going to do this. And they go, fucking yes.
Do you ever see the sketch we did where we pretended to be from the Labour Party and we literally just repeated back to people what they said?
That's what he did in Blackpool, yeah. But I think you're conflating that, which I agree with, he has no vision, with he has no chance because he doesn't have a personality. But I think that's problematic on two grounds. One, I do think he has a personality. Is it Boris Johnson's? No. Does that mean he can't compete with him? No.
But since Alistair
Campbell...
And the
other thing is, personality is such a patronising way to look at how the British electorate vote. And if everyone's going to say the liberal elite media bubble...
Who do you think...
Everyone voted for Boris Johnson based on personality. They're lying to themselves.
Who do you think is the most
British public
important...
voted for Boris Johnson based on clarity of messages, based on vision, based on hope, based on personality. It was a multitude of things. And I think this personality narrative is old, tired, and actually, to some degree, irrelevant. Guys, just to let you know, he's taken off his glasses and he's breathing in through
Who do you think is the most important politician in the UK of the 20th century, 21st century? Who is it? Of one person, who do you think it is?
21st century is the...
The last 20 years. Julia has just put her head in her hands, by the way.
I get confused about the century.
No, but seriously.
Don't say Nigel Farage. Don't you fucking... No! Fuck you!
Absolutely Nigel Farage.
Don't you dare say Nigel Farage.
Absolutely Nigel Farage.
It's just Phyllis.
Oh my God.
All right, one thing I'll ask before we move on. What is it Labour needs then, if they're going to win in the next election? You know, say in 2025.
A charismatic leader.
And that's it?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's depressing, isn't it?
I mean, is it depressing or is it fucking easy? If that's all it needs.
I think that we have... I would hesitate to think of anyone who's currently on the front bench as having the capacity and the empathy...
Do you know who's not on the front bench?
Who's that?
Andy Miliband.
David Miliband.
David Miliband!
I don't want him. I don't want him.
David Miliband! We love this podcast.
What I want is Caroline Lucas.
Oh, my God's sake.
Okay. Tell me a better orator in the last 15 years.
I'm not saying, for God's sake, in that she'd be a bad idea. I'm just saying she's not a member of the
Do you know the biggest
party.
Problem with the Green Party?
She's a Green Party.
I went to a Green Party conference MP. Once. Do you know what I saw?
Jolyon, to unpack what you're saying, what does the Labour Party need? A charismatic leader that it doesn't have within its entire representation in Parliament. So you're basically saying,
No, I'm not saying
So you're basically saying the
harsh.
Labour Party's next chance is completely... Hopeless.
Doing Tory light will... It is possible that in an election, if the polls remain similar to what they are now, 51-49, 52-48, something like that, that it is possible that someone could just come to power because it's a no vote for the Conservative Party. The problem is the scale of the Tory majority. Right now.
Yeah.
It's gigantic.
Yeah, totally. They can pass whatever they want, basically.
So, as evidenced in the most recent by-election, was a 10% swing to Labour. It made no difference.
Yeah.
To actually have a government that worked for both business and for the progressives is a really, really tricky balance. And I am someone who, way beyond the sort of hopeful narrative that I like to talk about, as I'm trying to talk today very openly about, there is a, I'm a political scientist, I'm very aware of the realities of quarterly return and how much that affects people's mindset. People want to see immutable and clear success within a given time frame. What is undoubted is that this government will not deliver that. Now, by any standards, you'd expect a Labour leader to be able to command some form of justice on that promise being revoked. It's the jury's out on whether that will happen.
Okay, still in May. Let's
fuck it.
Okay, that was part one of my extremely long chat with satirist, director, producer and dear friend of mine, Jolyon Rubinstein. I told you we interrupted each other. You had been warned. And in fact, that was me having edited out some of the worst of it. And actually, do you know what I was thinking? Just while I was editing it, there was times when I was thinking, how often in life do you have 5 hours or so of audio material or video material that is just you chatting? Just you being your absolute truest self. Because usually when we know we're being recorded, me included, even though I do this for a profession, you're switched on to some degree and you're kind of, you're careful and you're monitored and you're self-editing as you speak. Whereas this was not that. And it was a bit of a learning experience at times, listening to myself and how I can be. And at times I was thinking, this is interesting. And at other times I was thinking, oh, for God's sake, Julia. Like, it's almost an exercise that we should all do in many ways. There was moments where I was thinking, for God's sake, stop being so contrary and just acknowledge that he's made a good point or whatever it might have been. And it was a really interesting process and quite fun, especially to make it and to record it with Joel. Listen, check out the episode description and follow him and me on social media. Jolyon is very active on Twitter and on Instagram because, as you could hear, the man has a lot to say. And incidentally, if you are a patron, I'm going to try and look into posting a less edited version of our chat on there.
Because if you can believe it, there was much more that was said than what you heard now. But hold tight, because that will take me a while. And listen, the link to become a patron and to support the podcast is in the episode description as well. If you've been thinking about it for some time and, you know, if this podcast has been helpful for you navigating the year of 2021, it's Christmas. It's a time for giving. Why not, you know, chuck in £3 a month and keep the podcast going? That would be great. And make sure you've subscribed so you don't miss the next part of this special, or indeed any episode of Bare Naked Politics following on from that. All right, I hope you enjoyed our conversation, and I hope that you're okay wherever you are. I'll speak to you in the next upload. Goodbye.